writer's voice. To celebrate our 30 years of on-air service, Virginia Voice's Patty Campbell talks to noted writers about their lives and work.
I'm Patty Campbell, your host for these programs, and tonight I welcome Tom Lapis, who is the editor and publisher of the Henrico Citizen. Tom, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
The Henrico Citizen is a wonderful newspaper.
It was started and learned, you know, from its successes and some of its failures. And so when I started the Citizen, I had that background that was very valuable to me. And in some ways, I thought, you know, we're going to do some similar things, but we wanted to do some different things to reach more of Henrico County.
Interesting to me that you're actually not originally from Henrico County. How'd you get to Henrico?
I'm a Northern Virginia native and came down here to go to college at the University of Richmond and couldn't tear myself away from the region. Henrico reminds me a lot of what Herndon, where I'm from in Northern Virginia, was like when I was growing up there. Much different now, as we all know, how Northern Virginia has really exploded. But, you know, I love everything about Henrico. It's close to the city. I live in Verina now, so every day on my way to work, I drive past farmland. The ease of getting around, people are friendly. You know, the whole thing sold me on it, and I can't see myself being anywhere else.
I understand that there are two very important women in your life, one you work with and one you will soon marry.
Correct. Yeah, my fiancée, Bridget, means the world to me. Obviously, we've been together about 5 years now and planning our wedding for next June, so looking forward to that. And then Patty Krzyzewski, who's been with me from the beginning. She's my managing editor for the paper, has been tireless in her efforts over the years, really is a wealth of knowledge and in terms of what we do from the paper's perspective. She's she's a networker all about town, and she comes up with so many great story ideas on her own that I really don't have to do much other than get out of the way. So we kind of complement each other pretty well that way.
And the two of you write most of the paper.
We do. You know, we pride ourselves on having a lot of original content, and we try to cover things that folks are not getting anywhere else. I cover a lot of government, and Patty writes a lot of feature stories, and so we try to have a good balance of information. You know, I always like to say that anybody who lives or works in Henrico should pick up our paper and be able to learn something new that they didn't know. And that's the goal, you know, to educate people. I think that an educated community is a more active and involved community. So if we can play a little role in that, we're happy to do it.
We're interested in what you've brought to read for us today. Was this published in the Henrico Citizen?
It was. This is an article that I kind of stumbled onto actually a couple months before I started the paper and just never had a chance to research it until a few years later. And so it finally ran in, I guess, May of 2004, and it was a timely piece. That month was the 50th anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education landmark integration ruling. And as you'll hear when I read the article, it's very timely in that sense, and just a really neat story that I was proud to stumble onto.
Well, we're looking forward to hearing
yes.
it.
It's called For the Love of One. It is 67 miles from Farmville, Virginia, to a quiet plot of land in eastern Henrico County. In between, stately pines stand at attention alongside rolling hills of green, and dusty gravel trails lead to nowhere in particular. The trip along this lonely highway is not a difficult one, nor remarkable, but for a six-year-old girl more than 40 years ago, it was both. Fate carried her across those 67 miles, or was it hate that pushed her? She came for reasons that she was too young to understand, and because of people who she did not know. It is only 67 miles this trip, but were it 6,700 miles, it could have seemed no farther. Dozens contributed to her journey, and to the tale that would become hers. Their names are mostly forgotten now, though never known to more than a few. The story they helped create, however, has persevered quietly in the decades since. It is a story of pain and of frustration, of opportunity and hope. Mostly, though, it is a story of love, one that no one has known in its entirety until now. The year was 1961. Sally Ann Harris was 6 years old. The fertile farmland and wooded acres of Prince Edward County, Virginia, hid a secret in the 1950s that the rest of the nation, and indeed the rest of the world, would learn soon enough. Blacks and whites in the county greeted each other cordially on the streets and conversed as if they were content with their otherwise separate and unequal lives. Some, however, were not. One April morning in 1951 at the town's all-black Robert R. Moton High School, 16-year-old student Barbara Johns decided she'd had enough. She helped organize a phony assembly, then took the stage and ordered staff members from the building. They complied. One was a young home economics teacher named Hilda Johnson. Johns and student government president John Stokes then led their classmates from the school and into the streets of Farmville, where they marched in protest of severe overcrowding. The school held more than 400 students, but was meant for only 175, and lack of government funding. Conditions at the town's all-white high school were infinitely better. The black students sought the equality they deserved. 3 years later, the U.S. Supreme Court heard their cry and issued its landmark Brown v. Board of Education decision, which required public schools to integrate. The Brown decision was based on 5 cases nationally, including the one filed against Prince Edward County on behalf of the black students. But during the next 5 years, little changed. Virginia's massive resistance efforts delayed integration in most localities, including Prince Edward, whose Board of Supervisors voted in 1955 to allocate no money for desegregated schools. Many localities then adopted the so-called freedom of choice policy, whereby citizens could choose where to send their students. But the policy mostly encouraged white students to continue attending previously all-white schools, and black students to continue attending all-black schools. It was an utter failure. Finally, in 1959, faced with another court mandate to integrate the county schools, Prince Edward's Board of Supervisors voted instead to close them altogether. It would take a federal court order to pry open the doors some 5 years later. Prince Edward was the only county in the United States to close its schools for such a prolonged period in order to avoid integration. It was a time when a lot of things took place and a lot of people were concerned, the former Hilda Johnson recalled recently. It was not only a national concern, but a worldly concern, to think that this is happening in the United States. Everybody moved on as best they knew how. Having effectively banned black students from its schools, the Prince Edward supervisors quickly supplied funding for the private Prince Edward Academy for whites in Farmville, which opened in the fall of 1959. Many, but not all of the county's white students continued their education there. The academy is today known as the Fuqua School. Black families, meanwhile, scrambled first to comprehend what had happened, then attempt to overcome it. Solutions were not easy. The effects of the closure reverberated from many angles through the Harris family of Farmville. Alexander and Emma Harris, natives of the county, were raising 6 of their 8 children there at the time. The oldest two, William and Raymond, already had completed school and were working. Alexander, like many in the appropriately named community, was a farmer who grew crops and tended animals. The family's oldest daughter, Carol, was a member of the last Moton High School class to graduate before the shutdown. Linwood Harris was in the first class whose graduation never occurred because of it. Emma Harris still can remember clearly when she heard the awful news. "I got the message that first day that the schools were closing and that the school children were coming down the highway," she recalled in a hushed tone. "Can you imagine over 100 children walking down the highway into Farmville? And when they got down there, I was down there waiting for them. It was just terrible. A lot of the parents were upset, crying. I imagine I was too. But we just had to do the best we could." Though heartbroken for their son whose graduation had vanished, Alexander and Emma had 4 younger children, Shirley, Alice, Milton, and Sally, who were at critical developmental ages. They did not intend to see the youngsters suffer as a result of the county's decision. The youngest, Sally, was to start kindergarten that fall. The family tried to enroll their children in the public school system of adjacent Cumberland County, but it was too late. The system, they were told, was full. With local options dwindling, a few Prince Edward families sent their children to live with relatives out of state. But for most black students, hundreds in fact, there were no other options. And 67 miles away in Henrico County, that stirred something in a confident young black teacher named Richard Harris. Perhaps it was the fact that he was only a handful of years removed from his own graduation from Henrico's only black high school, Virginia Randolph, in 1953. Maybe it was that he still vividly remembered stepping into the one-room schoolhouse in Hanover County, where he first began to learn. Or maybe it was because of the lessons he learned there at Goodall Elementary School, where the only teacher was his own mother, and where he and the other students rejoiced on the day water pipes were installed, for it meant their daily trips to a nearby spring were over. Whatever the reason, Harris, no relation to the Farmville Harrises, felt compelled to do something, anything. In his short time as a Henrico teacher, he already had demonstrated a willingness to take chances. Only a few years into his career, Harris had become an active member of the Henrico Teachers Association. The organization was the black teachers' equivalent to the Henrico Education Association, which permitted only white members. "There were open elections, and I decided to run," he recalled matter-of-factly, "and I won." Now the young man was president, and he had a voice. He used it to wonder aloud to Henrico School Superintendent George H. Moody what Henrico might do to help the students of Prince Edward County. Moody's response wasn't quite what Harris had hoped to hear. "The county would gladly accept as many students as it could," Moody said, "provided each paid tuition." Since most families in Prince Edward County lived modestly and couldn't afford such an expense, and since it would be difficult to locate strangers who might be willing to house and feed their children in Henrico, the idea seemed implausible. But, Harris thought, there might still be one other option. Several years after the 1951 student protest, Moton High School teacher Hilda Johnson took a teaching job in Cumberland County. Her chosen career placed her in the footsteps of her father, a prominent Farmville school teacher, who was known to virtually all of the community's black residents. Emma Harris had been one of his pupils. But now the timing was right for Johnson to set out on her own, away from the town where her family had deep roots. After a year in Cumberland, she traveled east and ended up in Henrico. It would be a fortuitous decision, one that would impact several lives. Here she accepted a job as a home demonstration agent, the title given to blacks who worked as county extension agents. In her new capacity, Johnson helped organize 4-H clubs, worked with children, and maintained her focus on homemaking trends. It was through her job that Johnson met pretty Jasper Cosby, a black woman whose own career in education made her an associate of famed Henrico educator Virginia Randolph. Cosby and Randolph had first worked together years earlier to devise tuberculosis testing and treatment for local black students who couldn't afford either. They became fast friends. Cosby hosted regular meetings of the home demonstration agents in her area, meetings that Johnson regularly attended. One evening, Johnson's attention shifted from the topic of the meeting to the sight of an attractive young man in the house. It was Cosby's son, William, a Henrico teacher. The two would marry several years later. In time, William Cosby became principal of an all-black elementary school in Henrico County. If Prince Edward County parents could not pay for their children to attend school in Henrico, Richard Harris thought, then maybe Henrico's black teachers could pay for them. "I brought the idea to the association, and they bought into it," he recalled. The HTA agreed that it would try to raise enough money to pay for the tuition of several Prince Edward students and bring them to Henrico. The organization had about 70 members at the time. Quickly, it turned into a fundraising operation. "We sold candy. We had a popularity contest. We did all sorts of things to raise the money," Harris said. Following weeks of events and donations, many from the teachers themselves, Harris counted the total collection. The HTA had raised enough money to support one child. "It was amazing," William Cosby recalled during a 1987 interview with the Virginia Tech researcher. One of the teachers in the organization, Juanita Brown, volunteered to house the child in the home she and her husband shared. The couple had no children of their own. But the process was not quite complete. Harris needed Moody's permission to finalize the arrangement and authorize the placement of a Prince Edward child in the county. And according to Harris, Moody was less than anxious to provide it. "He did everything he could to discourage me," Harris said. "So, being young and not afraid, I just kept insisting. Some of the older principals said, 'You better walk lightly.' But I felt that if I could get that job, I could get another one." Despite several requests by Harris, Moody delayed a face-to-face meeting that would complete the arrangement. Finally, Harris called the superintendent again and asked to see him. This time, Moody agreed and invited Harris to his house. When Harris arrived, he showed Moody a piece of paper with dozens of signatures on it. "I told him I had the support of all the black teachers in the county," Harris said. "We had raised enough money to do it." Moody studied the document for a time, paused, then added his own name to it. "He was just as mad as he could be," Harris said. "He signed it and kind of slung it back at me." For one student in Prince Edward County, school had just reopened. By the end of the school year in 1961, the youngest four members of the Harris family of Farmville were scattered. One was in Jetersville, one in Charlottesville, one in Lunenburg, and one in New Jersey. Opportunities for education existed in these places, and they did not in Farmville. Though it tore at the Harris parents to split their family apart, they knew they were the fortunate ones. Most of their neighbors had nowhere to send their children for schooling. Sally Harris started her education in Atlantic City, New Jersey, where she lived with older sister Carol. But then Emma Harris, who had maintained occasional contact with Hilda Johnson Cosby, learned of the Henrico Teachers Association's efforts to fund one child's tuition. That one child could be Sally Harris, if her family approved. Emma Harris had an aunt and a close friend living in the Richmond area at the time. The scenario gave her the peace of mind necessary to send her baby away. That fall, Sally Harris made the 67-mile journey from her home in Farmville to a one-story brick schoolhouse on Buffin Road in eastern Henrico County for the first time. The principal waiting to greet her on that quietly historic first day was William Cosby. Though racial tension was noticeable and at times prominent in Richmond during the 1950s and 60s, it was less discernible in Henrico at the time. Blacks and whites went about their daily lives in relative peace, often because their circles of movement did not overlap. "I didn't really encounter a lot of whites," recalled Lloyd Jackson, a classmate of Richard Harris's at Virginia Randolph, who retired in 1993 after a 34-year career as a Henrico teacher, principal, and administrator, and now serves as the Fairfield District representative on the Henrico School Board. "We didn't affiliate with one another." During the heated period of integration and massive resistance, there were occasional difficulties, as William Cosby recalled during a 1987 interview. "I remember coming to my school one morning and taking KKK signs from off the doors and light posts leading to the school," he told a Virginia Tech researcher. Still, with scattered exceptions, whites and blacks in the county were respectful to each other, according to Jackson, Harris, and others. Perhaps the most difficult aspect of it all was simply the recognition of the system that found it acceptable to teach blacks in one set of schools and whites in another. "It was tough, but then it wasn't, because we grew up in that kind of an environment," Harris said. "We just sort of expected it. We didn't expect anything else. We learned to survive, and even in the midst of that, we found ways to overcome it. And I suppose it even made us stronger." Said Jackson, "It was almost like two school systems. Even though it was not right, even though it was illegal, you sort of worked within the system and did as good a job as you could. Though the freedom of choice concept was as much a failure in Henrico as it was elsewhere, there were moments, however fleeting, of hope." Harris recalled one such occasion, which occurred while he was the principal of all-black Fair Oaks Elementary School. "I looked out of the window and saw this white family pull in with two kids. I was waiting for them to appear in the office, and they never did," he said. "So I walked out into the hallway and asked a couple of seventh graders who were there, did they see a white family with two kids come inside? And they said, 'Yeah, Mr. Harris, we ran them off.'" Harris laughs heartily at the memory today. "That he can" demonstrates, in his words, how far we've come. "I guess their thinking was, well, we're not welcome at the white schools, so they're not welcome at ours." Sally Harris spent 2 years at Henrico Central Elementary School, today Mayfoot Elementary, 2 years living with Juanita Brown and her husband, 2 years making friends, practicing spelling, learning multiplication, and being a regular child. But she did so away from her family, something that regular bus trips home for the holidays couldn't quite overcome. "Just imagine sending your baby, 6 years old, away to school," Emma Harris said. The most trying moment during that period stands out in Harris's memory with all the clarity of a fire alarm piercing a silent school auditorium. Sally was returning to Farmville from Henrico for Christmas. She was traveling by bus. "It was snowing. All of the children had gotten home but her," Emma Harris recalled, her voice slowing to paint a picture of the afternoon. "I went down to the bus station about 3 o'clock thinking that she was going to be on that bus. She wasn't. And I waited and waited, and by that time I was all to pieces. The bus came in about 9 o'clock, and I asked the driver, 'Is there another bus behind you?' He said, 'There's one turned over on the side of the road coming from Richmond.' Well, you can imagine how I felt, thinking my baby was on that bus. Finally, the bus station closed, and they told the people to go to the train station to wait. So I went to the train station. There was nobody there but me. And finally, I saw this bus coming up the street, so I ran out in the snow. The snow came up over my knees. The bus driver opened the door, and he says, 'Lady, are you looking for somebody?' And I said, 'Yes, a 6-year-old little girl.' He said, 'Here she is, sitting right here. Is this her?' She was sound asleep, and somebody had pinned a note on her coat and put some money in it. So he picked her up and handed her to me, and there was a cab driver sitting there waiting. He said, 'Come on, I'll take you home.' He said, 'Where's the suitcase?' And I said, 'Don't worry about the suitcase. All I want is my baby.'" Though the story is hers, parts of it even today are foreign to the woman who many years ago was that little girl, alone and asleep on a bus one snowy night. Today, Sally Ann Harris is Sally Ann Beverly, the mother of 3 grown children and grandmother of 10. Twice married and once widowed, Beverly's life has taken her from Henrico back to Farmville, where she graduated high school in 1971, later to California, where she earned a bachelor's degree in health science, and then to Hampton Roads, where she now lives with her mother. Her father died years ago. Upon returning to Farmville when the schools reopened, Harris was able to skip fourth grade and enter fifth grade. While most of her classmates were struggling to readjust to school, she was excelling. She credits her Henrico experience, and in particular the assistance of Juanita Brown, for that. "I was very fortunate," Beverly said, recounting her story for a reporter. "We were very blessed to have the parents that we did. They went way out to find a way for us to get to school. I'm sure there are some that didn't have that ability. To be frankly honest, I feel like it was a positive effect. It enabled me to reach out a little bit more and attain my goals. If that hadn't happened, I don't know where I may have ended up." Instead, she ended up at Chesapeake General Hospital, where she has worked since 1987 and now serves as a lab manager, overseeing three analyzers who check the blood work of patients. "From an early age," she said, "I just had this certain urge to help people. I love helping people." "It's heartbreaking when we lose somebody who we've been working on for a while," she said, perhaps unaware of the special meaning of her words. "But the satisfaction is seeing a patient who we didn't think was going to walk out the door. That's the satisfying part." Prince Edward County lost hundreds of somebodies in 1959. Some persevered to achieve in spite of it. Some could not. Beverly was one of the few who walked out the door. Through it all, her role model has been her older sister, Shirley Boulding, who was not able to finish school, but who still devoted herself to becoming a successful nurse. "The way she came through it was really fantastic," Beverly said. Last year, Beverly and her five other living siblings gathered with their mother in Farmville to watch as Boulding walked across the stage to receive the high school diploma that she was denied so many years ago. The ceremony was a small piece in the healing process for many former Prince Edward students whose educations ended far too soon. "Words can't describe that day," Beverly said. "It was wonderful." Today, Richard Harris and William and Hilda Cosby still call Henrico home. Though they had lost touch with the child whose life they touched decades ago, she remained in their thoughts from time to time. "It's been so long," Harris said recently while surrounded by Henrico history during a visit to the Virginia Randolph Museum on Mountain Road. "I'd love to know where she is." The museum is a home away from home for the Cosbys. 92-year-old William Cosby has served as a curator for several decades and still greets visitors with a warm smile and firm handshake. The couple lives in the same Glen Allen home in which he was raised. Pictures, paintings, and documents outlining the life of the building's namesake fill the small museum, which the Cosbys have maintained as a labor of love. It is important, critical even, that the story of Virginia Randolph and her efforts to educate young black children in Henrico County not fade from memory. This, a visitor can sense from even a short visit to this hallowed place and a brief conversation with the couple who keeps it. But perhaps lost in a wonderful sort of irony is the story in which they themselves played a role. Of this tale, there are no pictures on the wall, no signed documents tucked away neatly in notebooks, not a trace of the little girl who passed through these parts on her way to the rest of her life. Now her story, too, has been told. Those who helped create it, however, insist that they merely did what they should have done. "At that time, it was just the right thing to do," Harris said. "That's the way we thought of it, and even today, that's the way that I think of it. Those families in Prince Edward that couldn't afford to pay for their children's education needed help, and it was just the right thing to do." There are some who would question the value of one life or the impact that just one person might make. In this great sphere filled with billions, after all, what is one? The wide-eyed grandchildren who bounce about Sally Ann Beverly's Portsmouth home, they know. So too do the parents whose lives she has improved or helped save. 43 years ago, one little girl traveled 67 miles to Henrico County because one teacher believed she should, because one principal believed she could, because one mother and one father knew she must. She was just one small person caught unwittingly in the swirl of a national controversy, and hers is just one story. But oh, what a story it is.
And what a story it is. Thank you very much for sharing that, Tom.
Happy to do it. It was a neat story to work on and just a very powerful one that I think speaks to a lot of different elements. And
very powerful,
yeah.
And very surprising for a small community newspaper that's being put together by essentially two reporters. Tell me a little bit about how that came together, how you found out about it and how you got it together.
Sure. Well, it's, you know, you can find a story in places you wouldn't expect. I think I had actually just been Googling Henrico County a couple months before I started the newspaper, and happened upon a study that had been conducted at Virginia Tech of principals in Virginia over the decades. And they had interviewed 300 principals about all kind of different topics. And I happened upon the interview with William Cosby, and there was one line in his interview that mentioned something to the effect of having raised money to bring this one student in. And he didn't seem to remember many of the details in that interview, and the interview didn't discuss it any more in depth than that. But I just kind of held that back, and I thought, this might make a story someday. I knew that it was going to involve some research to actually dig and find out if there was anything there, and I just didn't get to it for a couple of years. And then when the Brown versus Board of Education 50th anniversary was coming up, I thought, if I'm going to look into this, this is the time to do it. And
how long did it take to write the story?
I probably worked on the actual writing for several weeks, if not a month. This was one of those stories that the story was there. Nobody knew the story, and that was the interesting part to me, is that once I had talked to all these folks and tracked some of them down, I was the only one that knew the entire story. And so, then my task, I felt the weight on me because it is such a great story. I just didn't want to screw it up, basically. So you just have to tell it, basically, how it is. And it was neat to work on.
You talked about your commitment to having a community newspaper. And as I listened to your story, I was thinking about the fact that you have to be a reporter and a businessman and a manager. So many hats. Right. To wear. I'm curious about the decision to do that rather than to go be a star where somebody else is wearing some of those other hats.
Right. Well, I don't know that I could be a star anyway, but I think at the time that I started the paper, I was young. I was 24 when I did that. And I look back on it now and think, what was I thinking? But in a lot of ways, I was naive in the right ways, I think, and I had ideas. We had a good staff. I was fortunate that a few folks came with me, and we really felt like we knew enough about Henrico County to try to improve on what we had already been doing with the other papers. And I figured that, if you put a good product together that people enjoy, the rest will kind of follow. And there have been some bumps in the road along the way, naturally, but, I don't regret it. I think that every day is a little bit different, and there's a lot that will go on in a given day that, maybe I don't get to write as much as I would like to sometimes, but you kind of take the good with the bad.
Well, we're really glad that you took time out today to come and be here.
It was my pleasure. I really enjoyed the opportunity. Thank you.
We've been talking with Tom Lapis, who is the publisher, the editor, and the owner of the Henrico Citizen. I'm Patty Campbell for the Virginia Voice.
You've been listening to The Writer's Voice. Listen online or download to your computer or MP3 player at www.virginiavoice.org. Virginia Voice. Connect by listening.